The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 57, for June 10th, 2010. Fight Club Soap. Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus from the Center for History and New Media. It's the show with all the semi-informed nonsense of your average tech podcast combined with the suspense and excitement of a college lecture. So for new listeners, you are in for a real treat. I'm Tom Scheinfeld here from foundhistory.org, here with the regulars, Dan Cohen from dancohen.org and Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hi, guys.
Hey there.
Hey, Tom. I'm definitely ready to spout off the top of my head.
Good.
That's right.
Things I only know partially about.
Good, good.
Making it up as we go.
That's how we like it. And I'm also happy to welcome back our very first two irregulars who were the first two people who joined us in our new guest spots, Jeff McClurkin of the University of Mary Washington and an author at ProfHacker. And Amanda French, who is, I'm now happy to report, a member of the CHNM team. We've roped Amanda in. How are you guys doing?
Good, Tom. Thanks.
Good. Jeff, let me just briefly, I don't think we've actually talked about ProfHacker's move to the Chronicle and what you guys are doing there. Maybe you could give us a little bit of news on that. And also, feel free to plug any other links you'd like to plug.
Sure. Well, as many of the listeners of the podcast know, ProfHacker had been started actually by Jason Jones and George Williams coming out of that camp last year. The Chronicle was interested in in bringing ProfHacker and the various columns that it produces to their readers, and so we saw it as a chance to get an even broader readership, and so I think we've certainly gotten that a lot of new readers, and it's been a pretty good move for us. So
great. And where can people find ProfHacker?
Well, if you can go to ProfHacker.com, and it will automatically take you to the Chronicle site, the Chronicle of higher ed site. You can go to chronicle.com, and then it's not as simple as just chronicle.com/ProfHacker, but it's one of the columns that you can find there. But ProfHacker.com is the easiest way to get there.
Great, and I know you can follow ProfHacker on Twitter as well. I think it's just at ProfHacker.
It is. That's right.
Great. And Amanda, you've now joined us here. You're not physically here in Fairfax at the Center for History and New Media, but you have joined us on our That Camp project. Could you maybe say a little bit more about your new gig and actually the regional That Camp program that we've launched?
Absolutely. Well, as you know, Tom, because you wrote the grant, Mellon has given CHNM some money to, as we put it, leverage That Camp for digital humanities education, which just means that, you know, there's all of these That Camps kind of popping up around the world, and I'm coordinating those and helping people organize That Camps, and in particular helping to implement a series of workshops at various That Camps, you know, helping people find instructors, helping people, you know, provide workshops that are going to be useful for people who attend them. And just in general, you know, helping everybody who wants to organize an unconference organize one. And as I've been saying, and am probably not allowed to say for much longer, so far my job has been mostly keeping up, just trying to keep up with all of the people who are really interested in having that camps. And I think in the next couple of months, at least, I hope to get out ahead of the wave and start actually, you know, for instance, initiating new things. So we're developing a little piece of software that'll make it really easy for people to build a that camp website on WordPress. We're looking at maybe you know, trying to convince people who are not already organizing that camps to organize them, that sort of thing. So I'm really enjoying it, and I appreciate the chance to telecommute.
Great, great. Yeah, we're really happy to have you on board. And the That Camp movement, as Dan has been calling it, has really...
Like the Olympics.
Like the Olympics, has really taken off. So we're just thrilled about that. And any listeners who are interested in organizing a That Camp, please get in touch with Amanda. don't get in touch with me. Get in touch with Amanda.
info@thatcamp.org has been very busy with emails from Canberra in Australia recently. They just opened up their call for participants for That Camp Canberra. We've gotten just nibbles from places like Poland and Chile in South America, you know, as well as places closer to home like That Camp Bay Area, which I'm actually super psyched about. I think that one's going to be held at the WordPress headquarters. And so it's going to be that one is going to bring a lot of technologists together with academics, which is the part that everybody really likes best about this, I think. So.
Can I insert a quick plug here for That Camp London, which is coming up in early July. I believe it's the 6th and 7th in London at King's College. And I'll be there. And it looks like we've got lots of people coming now. I think Amanda and I were a little worried that it would be lightly attended, but I think we're maxing out. But there's still some room. If you're listening to this relatively close to the release date, hurry and get your mouse over to thatcamplondon.org and sign up. I think there's still some slots left, but we are rapidly approaching, I think, 80 people. So get in. We'd love to see you there.
And we do still have spaces in That Camp Tahiti, so be sure and sign up for that one as well. It's a little more expensive for the flights, but way better than London.
You Sounds laugh, great. Mills, but you won't laugh so hard when you're attending That Camp Jersey Shore, which is in Atlantic City.
I'm so glad there's the That Camp Jersey Shore. I think we should all go on a road trip up to that.
I actually think we should make a reality show out of it. Probably won't be as interesting as the original That Camp, the original Jersey Shore reality series. But you know, you never know. We digital humanists like to party as much as the rest. So lots of news this time around. We've been off the air for a little while, and it seems like this is some kind of a pattern, maybe. But as the only regular of Dan Mills and I who doesn't use any Apple products anymore, I seem to be the one who is always saddled when I'm hosting with the Apple news. And this week we've got more Apple news. Steve Jobs announced the iPhone 4 on Monday. We're recording here on, what date is it? The 9th of June. And on, I guess on the 7th, Steve Jobs announced the iPhone 4.
Tom, I'm actually broadcasting live from the line at the Apple Store that I got in on Monday, immediately following Steve Jobs getting up on stage.
Good. Well, we'll have a first look at the device once you've made it through the line. Well, Dan, maybe you could give us a little bit of an idea of what is new here and what might be interesting for the campus crowd. It's actually a new device and also a new version of the operating system.
Yeah. So on the device itself, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty much what people expected. It's a snazzy update to a already good looking device. I think that the advertising and I think what everyone will see as the kind of selling point is this FaceTime application, which allows the same video conferencing that has been available on Skype for the past 5 years. To me, that's a little bit less exciting. And I think from an academic standpoint, it'll be great for students who want to do things with their phones. But I think that I think the real big news, to be honest, and I think it came out not only in the description of the phone, but in some of the other things that are going on at Apple, is that I think Apple is angling in a way that is very attractive to the academic market by focusing on something really unrelated to FaceTime, which is legibility and reading and the immersive experience of text in a way that Android is not, and I think is going to become a clearer differentiator in the next year. I think that this, really the big story for me, is that this phone has a screen that is to older phones what the laser printer was to dot matrix printing, if you remember that from the 80s. When that first laser printer came out, which cost $10,000 from Apple, but when you looked at it, you were astonished that you could actually at home have a printout of your essay that looked as good as the published a published work in a book. And you know, I had that old dot matrix printer. It was ugly, it was distracting. And I think by going to over 300 dots per inch, you know, obviously I haven't seen the phone yet, but the descriptions have been that it's really like looking at a piece of paper. And I think that that is enhanced by the fact that John Gruber, who's a commentator on all things Apple and is also kind of a fanboy of Apple, but he noticed something else important, which is that the screen itself for this new iPhone, which has the very silly name of the Retina display, but beside the marketing, it's much closer to the surface of the glass than other phones, including the older iPhones. So it actually does look like evidently a piece of paper. I mean, obviously it's glowing from the LED, but I think what's going to happen over the next year is Apple is going to be focusing on their devices as really killer, non-distracting devices in a way that Android will not be. Android will be will remain the kind of anti-Apple. It will focus on lots of features and notifications all over the place and little blinky things. And I think what Jobs is going for with the iPad and this new iPhone is we're going to provide you with an experience where you completely forget about the computing device and you're immersed in very, very high quality visuals at high DPIs. I'm sure we're going to see this on the iPad next year is a Retina display for the iPad too. And it will be just a killer, killer reading device. You know, I think little noticed on Monday was the fact that they also released a new edition of Safari, which has built in something that I've been using for close to a year now, which I just love, which is the readability bookmarklet for any browser, which allows you to take any web page and strip it of ads, images, everything except just the text, and it reformats it into a beautiful single column of text that's not distracting. And I find myself more and more, I think Nicholas Carr's new book on this is right, despite my qualms about Nicholas Carr, but I think he's right that we've gotten too distracted with windowing systems on computers, and that Steve Jobs has decided he's going to attack that by getting rid of windowing systems, making sure that there's a very immersive experience with no distractions on his devices, including browsers, iPhones, and iPads. And it'll be the place for academics to go when they want to kind of get away from the web in kind of all of its distracting 2010-ness.
Yeah, there was actually, it seemed like there was kind of an asynchronous exchange between Steve Jobs and Steve Ballmer from Microsoft over the last couple of weeks, where, you know, one is saying that the era of the PC is over, and the other and Ballmer saying that, you know, the PC is not over, that the iPad is really just another PC. And but I think you get at it exactly, Dan, with the idea of distraction and distraction free. I think that, you know, the critics of the iPad and of the iPhone actually say, you know, it's not open, I can't mess with it, I can't do anything with it, it's kind of closed, it's locked down. I you know, the input mechanisms, you know, there's not a physical keyboard, there's, you know, I can't do what I want to do with it. But that, I think, you know, that is sort of the point of and where Steve Jobs is going. Any other thoughts about the new iPhone, or actually now that we've had a chance to get our hands on the iPad, any thoughts on that, Amanda or Jeff or Mills?
Yeah, actually, I guess I'm a little surprised to hear you say that about distraction-free reading, Dan, just because for whatever reason, I'm more or less anti-iPad as an ebook reader. And one of the reasons I'm a little anti-iPad, just for myself, is that it has all the other applications on it. You know, it's got a web browser, it's got, you know, incredible video viewing capabilities and things like that. And I don't want any of that. I really don't want an iPad, even though I have played with them a few times since it's come out, but I still want a Kindle, because a Kindle is a one purpose device. And that to me is my definition of, you know, that immersive experience.
Yeah, it's easy to sort of forget about the Kindle and all of this, but I think the Kindle is still doing very well, and we've seen in an effort, I think, to compete with the iPad there, I think the Kindle is going to be sold in retail stores starting very soon,
Target
among them.
Yeah. I would add that, I mean, it's interesting because to hear all of this as well, because I, you know, one of my favorite apps on my iPod Touch is actually the Kindle app on the iPod Touch, right? So it's Amazon software on the iPad, and actually I read a number of books on it all the time. And so the notion of an iPad having that and having that larger screen, and now with the new iPhone with a high resolution screen, I think I can see myself reading even more on there. The other question about distraction, it seems to me, I mean, one of the things that I had been looking for, lots of people have been looking for in this software update beyond the hardware of the new iPhone, is multitasking. You can run, and more importantly, perhaps switch between various programs fairly quickly. That's something that a lot of people had been looking for. It was one of the big knocks on the iPad, Amanda's comments notwithstanding. I mean, I think that this makes, for me, it makes it an even more appealing device in the educational market, when you could have, you know, a reading app and a note-taking app side by side, whether it's an iPad or an iPhone or an iPod Touch. I think it opens up even more possibilities, raises questions about distraction, things like that. But I'm going to leave that one alone.
Yeah, I mean, I think I am a iPad user, and I'm actually almost rueing the fact that it's going to get multitasking, because I fear that, you know, I'll be tempted to play Pandora in the background while I'm reading something. And right now, I guess, Amanda, what I was sort of talking about, I totally agree that the kind of one device for reading works better. And I am weak, so the temptation to kind of switch over to your email program is strong. But what the iPad, and actually whatever it has been rebranded as iOS, what those devices will have is that you don't see what Edward Tufte called in the early 90s, when, you know, he was sort of ragging on Windows, was that you don't see Windows. You don't see what Tufte called computer administrative debris, which I think is a great name for it, which is sort of all that stuff around the edges of your Word document that distracts you from the actual column that you're reading or writing. And I think what these iOS apps are doing is that they've gotten rid of that. They go all the way out to the edge. There's not even scroll bars, so nothing is taken up except the content. And I think that there is something now to that is important. I think the Kindle does it even better, right? Because, you know, other than a little bit of a strip at the bottom to tell you where you are in the chapter, it's got almost no computer administrative debris. I think the multitasking hides that, the multitasking under a kind of lift up sort of shade type animation. So maybe that will be okay. But I do think that there's something to this, that we're going to have to force ourselves into devices that maybe limit our experience in some way. And I have no doubt that when the Android tablets come out, they'll have all kinds of bells and whistles and things going on and notifications. And I think Steve Jobs and Johnny Ives will be sitting there snickering, saying that's just the wrong way to go. It's repeating the mistakes of the PC era that, you know, that Edward Tufte, the great designer, kind of identified in the early 90s.
Well, to some extent snickering, but also one of the things, I mean, and this is not something that Steve Jobs would admit directly, I don't think, but this new phone is in some respects a response to the challenge of Android, though. I mean, there are features, certainly in the operating system, which, I mean, multitasking is one of those responses. Unified inbox, that's another one. the background wallpapers, so you can change the wallpapers. You can have folders for apps. That's something that Steve Jobs resisted for a long time, and told us that we didn't need. Those are all things that have been in Android since the beginning. And I think there's this kind of the Android or the Windows alternative aspect of the new iPhone, but it also knows, I think, it's competing with those systems, and that's going to be a tough line for Apple to walk, I think. And I think we'll have to see as this plays out. We're also seeing a ton of new Android hardware coming out and new Android software. I mean, Android is definitely the platform for the tinkerer. It's for the person who likes all of that administrative debris. I think, you know, there's it's filled with all kinds of Easter eggs, and the settings menus are vast and intricate. It's building in innovation like in the new Froyo Android 2.2. You can set it up as a Wi-Fi hotspot. I think in the end, this competition between Android, iPhone, and I think the Kindle still is out there. There's more to come from Kindle, and I think we'll see some more from Microsoft and from Palm, which was bought by HP since our last podcast. I think there's a lot of competition in that space, but I think that's going to be good for everybody.
I think we all know, though, that the next version of Kindle will be very iPad-like, and it will do many things, and I think it will upset the purists like Amanda, who really wanted just a really solid reading device with an e-ink screen. I have no doubt that the next Kindle will have games, and it will have a better web browser, and it will have email, and it will have all these things. It will sort of have to, unless it's going to be $59 or free when you buy 10 books at Amazon.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree with that. And I think we're seeing that kind of call and response across the board here. Well, moving on from the iPhone, moving on from Apple, our favorite topic of discussion, to our second favorite topic of discussion, Google. We saw in the last couple of weeks, Google came out sort of just in the way that Google does, just kind of an offhand remark on one of their blogs. They have launched and released what looks a lot like a learning management system called Cloud Course. Mills, have you had a chance to look at Cloud Course?
Yeah, I took a look at it, and I tried yesterday, actually. I downloaded it, and it's technically over my head right now. I tried installing things, but it helps to know a little Python, which is well beyond my capabilities. And so it's not the kind of thing that at this moment, the average faculty member who wants to set it up and run with it for their course is going to be able to do. You still need some kind of administrative computing support, or a grad student who knows, or an undergrad who knows a little Python. But I did look at a couple of the samples, and I think once they make it a little more user-friendly for the average user, because it's not designed for higher education, it's designed for enterprise learning environments, corporate training, that sort of thing. And so it doesn't have many of the same kinds of features yet that we see in the course management software that has swallowed most of our campuses, but it will. And because I think a number of colleges and universities are going to jump on it and start installing, creating, since it's open source, creating grade books and things like that it needs. But it looks like a much sort of stripped down version of what you see in course management or learning management software platforms. But it's because it's still very basic. And in the way that Google does, they've put it out there with some nice basic features and capabilities, and then said, okay, go ahead, play with it and see what you can come up with. So I think it's going to get a lot more sophisticated fairly quickly. And I expect that fairly soon someone will hack it in a way that makes it possible for average Joes like me who know no Python to get it set up and going. If you don't need all the bells and whistles, it's fine. And if you have somebody who can help you set it up, it's fine. A year from now, I think it's going to be something that we see a lot of use of at those institutions that are moving toward the cloud. At those institutions that aren't, it's just not going to happen except for the individual faculty member who decides, yeah, I would rather do this than Blackboard or Moodle or whatever.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about cloud cores is not just, you know, the fact that Google releases what some people are calling a learning management system, even though it isn't really. It's really a course scheduling app. But it does integrate with Google Calendar. So, you know, any enterprise that is reliant on Google Calendar, and I think many are, would find that very attractive, because calendaring systems are, you know, something that actually a lot of universities, I think, are all having the same kinds of problems with those as they are with email. You know, the fact that everybody's already using some kind of calendaring system when they get to the university, and then if they're employees or staff or whatever, they're supposed to be using, you know, whatever software the university has decided to use. And they may just sort of, you know, cut through all that hassle by saying, look, let's just use systems that integrate with what people are already using when they get here.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. As the only member of the podcast who uses the George Mason University internal administrative calendaring system, which I've now abandoned, but I had to use last year while I was working in the dean's office, I can say, you know, it's a nightmare. And it is the thing which is, and it's a big enterprise platform, which is used, I would guess, by thousands of organizations around the country, around the world, because it's from a major software manufacturer that I won't name. And it's just
Oracle, isn't it? You're talking about Oracle, aren't you?
What is that amendment to the Constitution? The fifth one? Yeah, that's the one I'm going to use. So, it's clunky. It's horrible. And after being a Google Calendar user for 2 years, to have to then use that for a year was just like sticking small pins under my fingernails. And now, you know, the day that I stopped working in the dean's office was the last day I logged onto that system. And so it's for me, one of the things I've been thinking about for this fall, I'll be back teaching again in the fall. You know, my students are always trying to figure out what's the best time to get in touch with me. And so I think what I'm going to do is kind of rejigger my Google Calendar so that they can at least see the blocked out times. And so they'll know when I'm in the office, even not my normal office hours. And so I think that alone is just, which I can't do with that other system that I'm not going to name. And so, because they can't get access to it because it's an administrative system. So, that alone makes life a lot simpler. And so if I could then start building things on top of that calendaring system that I'm already very reliant on, I don't want a whole course management system, but I do want some things that make life easier for me as an instructor in interacting with my students. And so if I can start adding those bits onto my Google calendaring system, I'm going to love that. I don't need a whole thing, a whole big management system. I just like some modules, or maybe we should call them apps.
Jeff, you and your colleagues at University of Mary Washington are well known for kind of alternative educational technology systems, UMW blogs being the best example. Is this the kind of thing that Jim Groom and his people of his ilk, let's say, he's a friend, so I think we can say that, would be interested in, or is this kind of more of the same, just from a different company?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that certainly the early conversations with Jim and some others at Mary Washington suggest a real kind of excitement about the potential of this particular idea. I mean, again, the problem is as Amanda and Mills have pointed out, this is a relatively basic beginning, right? I mean, it's got scheduling, it's got notions of how to not just calendar scheduling, but room scheduling, ways to begin to manage rosters of classes. And that's the beginnings. That's the beginning structure of perhaps what we might call a learning management system. But it's still pretty early on, and I think it's got a ways to go. Now, you know, at some point, I think, as Mills says, within the next year, we're going to see something built on this that that's a little more user-friendly that I think we would probably be interested in looking at. You know, again, for me, there were two points that from this particular announcement that surprised me, I guess. I mean, one is that you know, that lots of people seem to hate not only their calendaring systems, but their room scheduling systems. And that the notion that this could somehow replace whatever third-party or proprietary software people are using, or in some cases no system at all for scheduling the rooms, is, I think, incredibly, it speaks to the need in this area, and perhaps Google sees that and is tapping into it. But even more amazing to me, I think, was the general reaction that I saw on Twitter and in other places in the blogosphere, to the possibility of an alternative learning management system. You know, Mills may say that he's not interested in necessarily using it this way, but I think a lot of people are really just excited by the idea, even though there's nothing here yet that is really a learning management system. But I think there are a lot of people who are really excited by the potential of offering alternatives to what we currently have.
Well, and as somebody who had to spend a lot of time last year working, interacting closely with the people who schedule classrooms on our campus, we use a whole different large corporate system for that, and which is it's not the same level of nightmare, but it's just not very good, and it's just difficult to use, and you know, only a couple of people are expert enough to actually make it work, and the rest of us interact in kind of strange ways, but ultimately it happens. But that is, the scheduling of classrooms is an incredibly complex endeavor. You know, we have 159 classrooms at George Mason that are in use from 7:30 in the morning until 10 p.m. at night, Monday through Friday, plus some on the weekends. And they have all sorts of different tech capabilities and, you know, everything like that. And, you know, different numbers of seats and faculty, some faculty members only want to teach in certain buildings, which is too bad for them because it doesn't work that way, but they try. And so it's, you know, that's a really complicated set of algorithms. And if Google can figure out a better solution to that, I think you're going to see registrars perk up their ears, because it's registrars who are generally responsible for that particular issue on campus. And I think there's a wide open market for that.
Well, I think in some ways we were surprised by this announcement from Google. But in other ways, I guess it doesn't really come as much of a surprise. Google has been moving more aggressively into the education market with Google Apps for Education. And a lot of universities have been, as we've talked about on the podcast, have been switching to Gmail to provide to sort of outsource the email functions of central IT, Google Docs, and the other Google Apps applications. So
just on that point, though, this didn't seem like an aggressive move, to be honest, or as aggressive as I think a lot of us would have liked to have seen. I think I tweeted at the time I heard about it. If they had released a beta of courses.google.com, that would have been impressive. I think they put something up in the app engine. I think they're hoping, you know, it's open source. They're hoping for a developer community. But it, you know, I think a lot of us were hoping for like a nice sucker punch against Blackboard. And this just wasn't that. I think it's just a little bit too amorphous at this point. So,
well, absolutely. And it's clearly some kind of labs project, you know, yeah, or somebody's, yeah, 20% time. Right. But again, I think, as you said, Jeff, it's the reaction to this, or as you were saying right now, Dan, you know, the fact is that a lot of people would like alternatives to Blackboard and even to open source learning management systems like Moodle or Sakai. And there's some sense that, oh, you know, we'd welcome our Google overlords into this space as a change from the other overlords.
Right. But I mean, to really replace it, it would have to be something that would be able to be run on the campus because of various legal issues. And so I think the fact that it's only running in Google's app engine is going to be problematic for that.
Well, but this, I wonder too, to get back to Tom's earlier question, I guess, you know, is this something that Google hopes the DIYU crowd, right, the do-it-yourself university crowd begins to pick up on? And that if it were a completely finished and polished app, that's a group that probably wouldn't necessarily be interested in jumping onto courses.google.com. I don't know. I mean, I'm just guessing here, but I wonder, it'll be interesting to see what happens indeed over the next year to this project.
It does feel a little like testing the waters. Well, moving on, you know, speaking of competition and alternatives, we saw also just this week that Microsoft rolled out its own version of a cloud solution for a cloud application solution, Microsoft Office for the web, and it has sort of, as far as I can tell, a couple different names that it's under. Microsoft Office Web Apps on SkyDrive is I think the official title.
How do they come up with these names?
I know, it's like typical Microsoft. It's like horrible branding, and they're targeting at 10 different markets and just can't get all their ducks in a row. But yeah, we have seen that Google has made some inroads in providing email and Office solutions in the cloud to universities, and it looks like Microsoft is making a fairly bold counter to that. This isn't specifically for the educational market, but essentially what this Microsoft Office web apps on SkyDrive does is it provides a web-based word processor, web-based spreadsheet, and just as Google, web-based presentation tool, just as Google Docs does. But what it does on top of that is it integrates with your desktop version of Microsoft Office, so that you could be working on a desktop copy of a document, save it to your desktop, and then that's automatically synced to the cloud, so that if you are later on in a different location and want to do some more editing in the cloud, you can do it there. And those changes are reflected in both places. And it can also be used for collaboration in that sense, that changes that you make on your local machine can be shared and replicated on a colleague's local copy of that same document. So it offers some features that that Google Docs doesn't. It also looks and feels like Word and Excel and PowerPoint, which I think is an important thing. Google Docs has always felt a little different for when you start using it, and these things look and feel just like the quote real thing. So a big play, I think, by Microsoft. What any thoughts on this? We don't tend to talk much about Microsoft on this podcast, but it is probably the software that most people on most campuses are using most often. Any thoughts on what this does for higher ed?
I mean, I think this is a smart move on their part. I mean, it's late coming, frankly. People have been calling for some kind of version of this ever since, Google Docs really rolled out, and began to collect some steam. I actually have had in some ways in the last month or so begun to switch over to using Google Docs more to write things, partly because it synced up pretty easily across machines. It didn't have to worry about thumb drives or any of that. There are other ways to do that, but it was just easier. So, I mean, I think this is a really powerful thing. I think, Tom, you're right, that the way things look and feel are going to matter a great deal to people who aren't interested in tinkering around, who want to just continue to use Word and PowerPoint and Excel and things like that. One of the interesting things for me, though, about this move is that you apparently can do the online stuff without actually owning a copy of Office 2010. I mean, I think that's great. I think they have to do that to compete with Google Docs. The problem is that does this potentially cannibalize the Office business any? And I don't know, maybe they're too big for them to worry about that. But I thought that it's an interesting sort of thing looking forward.
Yeah, I think Microsoft is in some ways facing the same dilemma that publishers are with making products open access on the web. Like, okay, they need to do this to compete, but how then do they maintain their business models? And I think it is in that way a pretty risky move for Microsoft. Dan or Amanda or Mills, any final thoughts on this?
I was just thinking that I do think it's a brilliant move. I think the drug dealer model should work pretty well for them. People are thinking about Google Docs can just get like a taste of what real Office is like on their live Series 7 XP, whatever, online live version. But I think there's something to these applications. I've just, my shorthand for them is, you know, fog applications. They're sort of like, you know, sort of in the cloud, but also on your desktop. And Google has gone all in, for obvious reasons, to cloud applications. And their upcoming book reader, which I'm sure we'll talk about this summer on the podcast, you'll have to be connected to the internet. It'll run in a web browser. I'm sure they're thinking ahead to their Chrome OS, which is different than their Chrome browser, which will need to be connected to the internet. I think there's still something for at least the next few years and probably longer where applications that run locally that connect to the cloud, that synchronize, will have a major advantage. And I mean, I think it's something we probably just by sheer luck stumbled upon in the Zotero project of having, you know, you always have a copy of everything you want on your own machine, but if you're connected to the internet, it synchronizes to the cloud and you can access it on the web. I think it's a really powerful model because desktop stuff works better. It just does.
It's just snappier.
And it takes advantage of all the local APIs that an operating system has to draw things better and to, you know, I mean, just cut and paste, all that stuff that is done with local APIs. It just gets all goofy in a web browser. And I don't think Google has solved that. I've had a lot of frustration. I know others at CHNM have with Google Docs. And so I think that the idea that you could just, you know, move something offline. Sorry if I'm getting some feedback here. I think it's a very attractive idea.
Well, that I think we'll have to wait and see. This is the first week of it, and I do think though it's gonna be an interesting thing to watch here, especially with school starting, and we'll see if any campuses make announcements about the Microsoft product as they have been about the Google product. Mentioned publishing very very briefly there, and another thing we saw this week was that the University of California is in a bit of a standoff with the Nature Publishing group, the group that publishes Nature, the journal Nature, and many other scientific journals. Turns out that Nature was asking the University of California system basically they hiked their price by what the University of California is saying is 400%. So they wanted four times the amount of money that the university had been paying for the subscriptions to almost 70 titles. And the University of California and the California Digital Library, which manages their subscriptions, decided to say no and to threaten a boycott of Nature if Nature didn't enter into negotiations about that price quote. They said that they would tell their faculty members to stop publishing, or they would ask their faculty members to stop publishing in Nature journals. They would ask their faculty members to stop serving on editorial boards or serving as peer reviewers for Nature journals, and they would stop buying the Nature subscriptions to the Nature journals if Nature didn't negotiate. What do people think of this? This seems like a fairly aggressive move by the University of California to stem the rising costs of journal subscriptions.
I think this is outstanding. I think it's absolutely fabulous. I'm sure you'll link to the letter that Gary Strong, head of the UC Libraries and others, put out. But the appendix to that letter is really worth a read because the numbers on this are amazing. I remember, they literally are. Nature really literally was proposing a 400% increase in what they were paying, going from, you know, an average cost per journal of about $4,465, which I bet is per year. I think that's a yearly subscription cost, to an average cost of $17,000.
Amanda, have you heard anything about this? I mean, as Nature said, is this just chutzpah? I mean, 400% increase? It just almost seems like unreal.
Nature has not, according to the what I've read, they have not responded to the letter yet, or at least not publicly. And they at least refused an interview to Jen Howard at the Chronicle. So it does sort of seem like chutzpah. I don't know if this came out of the blue or whether they had been in negotiations for a while and it ended up in a standoff. Has anybody else heard any more details on where this kind of comes from?
No, but I did read, and I actually Twittered earlier today, you know, of course, this is the Nature Publishing Group, which is one of many STM, you know, science and technical publishers. But another famous one is Reed Elsevier. And I was reading an interview earlier with a business analyst who was talking about how Reed Elsevier posted, you know, unprecedented profits in the last year's earnings and so on. And this business analyst was basically talking about, you know, you publishers cannot keep raising prices and raising prices and raising prices and earning these crazy profits, because at some point people are going to break. And he wrote this, you know, before this whole UC and Nature Publishing Group thing happened. And I mean, I think he's got to be absolutely right, because it's amazing when you look at the culture as a whole, where newspaper publishing is in trouble and everybody knows it. Book publishing is in trouble and everybody knows it. They're trying to hang on to earnings, trying to innovate, you know, to figure out new ways of dealing with the internet. And in scholarly publishing, it's exactly the opposite. You know, you have, you know, they're the opposite of being in trouble. They're just charging more and more and more. And, you know, for them, the move to online resources has been nothing but a cash cow. And it's been really amazing to me the extent to which open access publishing, the whole notion that you publish your scholarship online for free, has not so far been a threat to scholarly publishing. And the reason for that is basically reputation. You know, it's because it's a reputation economy, I think. So anyway, this strikes me as I hadn't heard anything about like why Nature Publishing Group thought they could get away with this or thinks they can get away with this. But I think that the answer is that historically for the past, you know, 20 years, they've been getting away with stuff like this.
I mean, it's pretty astounding. I just did some simple multiplication based on some of the numbers in that letter. The University of California, the California Digital Library, from what I can tell, they subscribe to about 8,000 journals online at an average cost of $3,000 to $7,000. So let's figure like 8,000 journals times $5,000 per journal. That's an online journal's budget of $40 million a year. I mean, that is astounding. Think of what $40 million looks like in a university's budget. So the numbers here are really, before this spate of articles, I don't think I had quite wrapped my head around just how much money we were talking about here. But that's just, I mean, it's a big state, but that's just one state university's library journals budget, $40 million.
Hard to believe. It's the UC system,
right? But
still,
it's hard
and
to believe.
It's not $40 million for cafeteria food. It's not, it's to return to the faculty the articles that they wrote in a formatted way.
Many of which were paid for by taxpayers.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the grants that did the research.
Beth Novitsky had the great term Fight Club soap, which is basically, you know, if you've read Fight Club or seen Fight Club, you know, they take this, well, I don't know, you'll have to, I'm not sure I can describe it right, but you take some, the output, someone's own output, and sell it back to them. At an outstanding cost. Yeah, it's obscene. It really is obscene.
Well, I think this is this could well be a very important turning point that we look back at later and say, oh yeah, that's when it really started, because, you know, California is certainly the biggest customer in the United States of online academic journals because it's the largest state education system in the United States. So they've got to be the biggest customer. And when the biggest customer says no, then the smaller customers are going to feel empowered. Well, if Berkeley doesn't have access to that journal, well, we can live without it too. And, you know, UCLA doesn't have access. Well, we can live without that because, you know, we're not done with budget cutting in this great recession that we're living through. And it's only, I mean, this is going to be a very low hanging fruit. And if I'm in the business side of the university and I read this, I'm calling the librarian and saying, hey, you know, you can save, how much are we spending on online journals now? I think we're going to look back at this and see, this is one of sort of those crucial moments in a trend away from paying these just obscene journal subscription fees, especially because so more and more, even though, as Amanda says, you know, it's a reputation-based economy on this, but more and more people are publishing in their own work in venues that are free. And the younger generation of scholars coming along behind those of us on the podcast, they're not as wedded to the old models. And the ease of publication, the open access nature of that publication, and the freeness of that publication, I think, is going to be very attractive to them. And you know, speaking for myself, I don't really care what the peer review of an article was, so long as the peer review happened. And so if it happened by an editorial board in one of these reputational journals, happened in the old ways by an editorial board but prior to publication, that's great. If it happened after, in some other way, and the scholar can show me how the peer review happened, that's peer review. So I think we're going to see some big changes, and it's going to be the cost that finally is the overreach on cost is going to be the nail in the coffin.
Yeah, I thought the most damning part of this was in the article in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, Keith Yamamoto, who's a professor of molecular biology at UC San Francisco, he made the just incredibly obvious commonsensical point at the end of this article, where he said, okay, what does Nature have? It has branding, right? It's just a brand name, and so that's why people want to publish in it. But then he says at the very end of this article, he says, you know what, though? In many ways, it doesn't matter where the work's published, because scientists will be able to find it. And I think that's the correct sentiment, is sort of like, as that spreads, Mills, exactly what you said, is that attitude kind of spreads. If scientists feel like, well, you know, I can just publish it to my personal website or an open access journal like PLOS or an institutional repository, and, you know, people find it. Google's pretty good. I'll let people know via social media or other methods, email. I think it's going to erode the brand that is Nature right now.
Well, let's see. I think we'll have to wait and see on this to see whether California will be like it is with auto emission standards, where California passes the law and the industry and the rest of the country follow suit just because of the sheer size of the state. I think Amanda, you're probably right. It could be that this is the start of something. Just to finish off the podcast here, we noticed one more thing, and maybe a little lighter, maybe not. Maybe this is disturbing. I kind of can't tell. It turns out that there was an article in Inside Higher Ed where they picked up on a story where a student was actually selling his course spot on Craigslist. So there was a over-registration in the course that he was signed up for, and he was trying to sell the spot on Craigslist to the highest bidder, to someone who needed to get into the course. Is this something we're going to see more of? Is this entrepreneurial, or is this a complete breakdown in the registrar's office?
Well, and it's actually a slight reverse to what you just said. It was somebody trying to buy one. They were offering.
Oh,
to
I
buy.
See. Okay, all right.
It was not offering to sell. Buy. Yeah, I actually have it up on the screen. The person in their posting apparently wrote, so if anyone is currently enrolled in any of the Bio 160 classes for summer quarter and is willing to sell their spot on it, or knows of anyone that is, please, please, please let me know ASAP. So somebody desperate to get in the class who's willing to pay. And I have to say, I was so excited when I read this, because it just proves that what goes around comes around. When back in the Stone Age when I was a college student, and we had such a great registration system. It was still on those fabulous little punch cards that computers used to use, and every seat in the classroom was represented by a card. And we all went into the gym, and we stood in lines at the English department or the history department table, and I asked for a seat in, you know, the Tuesday, Thursday, 9 o'clock section of History 300, and they flipped through the thing, and, oh, look, here's a card, and they handed it to me. And so I had a seat. Well, there were very entrepreneurial people standing in the middle of the gym who had gone table by table and selected the cards for the most popular sections by the most popular professors, and they were selling them. So that market has existed, as it turns out.
So nothing new under the sun.
All that's different is that about this particular story is that, and you know, who knows there's some question about whether or not it's true or not, or whether he was joking. But the fact is that this has been going on in some form for a while, whether, you know, you do it for your friends or whether you're actually selling it. What's different is that there's a kind of transparency that the web brings that makes it both easier to connect with these people who might be engaged in these practices, and for the rest of us to have a sense that it's going on.
Well, the other thing I think about it was there was a quote in this Inside Higher Ed article from somebody at the college who said, oh, well, no, this must be a fake posting because our registration system guarantees that if you really need the class, you're first on the list for getting into it. And I think everybody knows that's never true. I mean, of course, this is a real ad, it seems to me, you know, of course, you know, even though you really need the class to graduate, you know, somehow you got down at the bottom of the registration list. That happens all the time. Or, you know, I mean, people really, really need the course, meaning that they work on Fridays when the only other thing, you know, that would fit into their schedule is offered or whatever, you know, they, you know, so I think it just goes to show too, that there is room for Google to get into the class scheduling and class registration business, because I don't think that there is any system that would ever be perfect, but there are always going to be human systems that get around what the technological systems fail to do.
See, I think the student's mistake was posting it on Craigslist. They should have just looked for it on eBay.
Great idea.
Well, we're over time, so let's leave it there. Thanks to Jeff and Amanda for joining us again, and thanks to Mills and Dan. I think next time around it's Mills's turn, I believe. Mills, your turn next.
I think it's Dan's turn.
Oh, it's Dan. Yeah. All right. Well, it's Dan's turn.
Back in the saddle.
All right. Well, we'll
do this.
We'll try to be.
We'll talk about all Microsoft then.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. You're stuck with
Sweet.
Microsoft next time.
Thank you so much,
Dan. So join us for that exciting discussion on the next episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.